I'd like to call this meeting of the New York State Council of Human Blood and Transfusion Services to order. I'm Tim Hilbert, the chair of the council, and I'll turn it over to Matt.
Good morning. I'm Matthew Cohn. I'm the council secretary. As a reminder for our members and guests, the meeting is being recorded, and this recording will be available to the public on the DOH website. So please speak loud and clear when you need to. Speak one at a time. State your name before making or seconding a motion, and perhaps most importantly, please do mute if you are not talking. Dr. Hilbert?
Yeah, I'd like the board members and staff to introduce themselves by stating their names and affiliations, beginning with Dr. Elder.
Hi, I'm Rachel Elder. I am a pathologist at Krauss Hospital, the director of the lab and blood bank.
Dr. Husky.
Hi, I'm Dave Husky. I'm the governor's designee representing the people of the state of New York.
Jessica.
I'm Jessica Jacobson. I'm the director of labs and transfusion at New York City Health and Hospitals, Bellevue.
Dr. McCarthy.
Hello, I'm Philip McCarthy. I'm at Transplant and Cell Therapy Program at Roswell Park.
Dr. Schmidt.
Hi, I'm Amy Schmidt. I'm a medical director with Octa Pharma.
And Ms. Rausch.
Hi, I'm Beverly Rausch. I'm the commissioner's proxy for the council, and I'm an employee of the Wadsworth Center, the New York State Department of Health. I'm the director of the Clinical Laboratory Evaluation Program and the acting director for the Blood Resources Program.
And now the DOH members and staff in attendance will introduce themselves.
Again, I'm Matthew Cohn. I'm council secretary.
I'm Mary Beth Dooley. I'm with the Blood Resources Program for the Department of Health Wadsworth Center.
Okay. I'd like to thank all the council members for their time and commitment in making these meetings a priority. Your attendance and participation is critical to the success of the program. I'm going to introduce the members of the public who are attending today's meeting, all remotely. I will announce each registered participant. There is time reserved at the end of the meeting for public comment. Today's participants include Celia Clifford from American Red Cross, Grace Marie Sullivan from Connect Life, Heather Pratt from KED Plasma, Maria Loger from American Red Cross, Mark Houston from Farrell Fritz, Nellie Cherney from KED Plasma, Ruth Espinoza from KED Plasma, Joseph Curie from Arnaud Health, Zara Yalaki from Connect Life, Mary Catherine Belgira from Kedrion Biopharma, Scott Kittograd from Nassau County Police Department, and Gina Horan from American Red Cross. So today's agenda includes approval of the minutes of our January 27th, 2023 meeting and discussion of several blood services guidelines. Dr. Hilbert.
Okay. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes of our January 27th, 2023 meeting. Is there any discussion of the minutes from the members?
No.
Okay. May I have a motion to approve the minutes as presented with the edits discussed or the lack thereof?
This is Rachel. I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Anyone second?
Jessica Jacobson will second.
Then I guess there's no discussion, so the roll call vote by members named above. Dr. Elder?
Approve.
Dr. Husky?
Approve.
Dr. Jacobson approved already. Dr. McCarthy?
Approve.
Dr. Schmidt?
Approve.
The motion is approved. Our next order of business is the discussion of the blood service guidelines. There are two guidelines on today's agenda. We're starting with the elective out-of-hospital transfusion guideline, which was last reviewed in 2012. Ms. Rausch will describe the guideline and lead the discussion. Beverly?
Hi, thank you, Dr. Hilbert, and thank you everyone for joining today and persevering through our technical difficulties. And the goal of today's discussion is to obtain your thoughts on possible revisions to the guidelines, to provide some clarity and incorporate current best practices. Mary Beth and I have prepared some questions to prompt the discussion. During our discussion, please feel free to include any other relevant issues related to the guidelines that we may not have addressed today or predetermined discussion points today. Note that we will not be making any final decisions on the guidelines today, nor voting on adoption of any changes. Following today's meeting, we'll prepare draft revisions that we'll present at the next council meeting. As mentioned at the last meeting, we would like to continue with, at a minimum, annual meetings in the fall of each year. With that said, let's begin. A copy of the elective out-of-hospital transfusion guidelines was distributed prior to the meeting. Such transfusions would be performed in facilities approved as limited transfusion services, which include places like dialysis centers, ambulatory surgery centers, physician offices, and other diagnostic and treatment centers. Elective out-of-hospital transfusions would not include transfusions performed due to an emergent issue. Such situations require the transfusion to be performed in an appropriate healthcare facility, such as a hospital. For this guidance document, we're proposing to add a definition section to define the terms used, provide clarity on patient eligibility, requirements for staffing, and expectation for the return of blood components when a transfusion is canceled. So the first question we had, we wanted to propose definitions for the terms issuing facility and competent adult. Those are addressed in the regulation, but I think it warrants having some repetitive definition in these guidance documents as well. And there may be other terms that we would look forward to define in the future. The first question about that we had, we would like your input on, is under patient category A, or patient criteria A, I'm sorry, it states that the informed consent must be obtained from the patient. I think we want to clarify in these guidance documents that the out-of-hospital transfusions at a limited transfusion center cannot be conducted in an emergent situation, except for in ambulatory surgery centers. So therefore, we would want to be proposing to add some additional language to clarify that, so that therefore it's very clear that the informed consent, there would not be in those situations a proxy that would be necessary for such consent. In other emergent situations, there is a proxy, a healthcare provider can serve as providing that consent. Any discussion on that proposed revision?
This is Rachel Elder. Do we also want to add a duration for the informed consent? Each time or for a year? And our limited, I think we do as an outpatient, a year is good for a year.
Is that per hospital or institutional policy, or is that per, like, I know that we have a policy that states that it's good for up to a year if it's selected in that way. But I don't know.
That's institutional.
Do we typically define it, or do we just say as per institutional? I don't know.
That would be fine.
I know we don't define it in the regulation.
It has to be institutional because you may have a consent to transfuse red cells, but if the risk benefits and alternatives change from one instance to the next, the consent is no longer valid.
This is Rachel Alder. So are you saying maybe we just put in per institutional guidance?
I mean, I would be okay with that. I don't know if people think it's necessary or not, because clearly your institution is going to define their, well, I would think that most facilities would define their requirements for informed consent, but, you know.
I mean, my only question would be for a surgery center, at least our surgical consents permit transfusion unless the patient has crossed out the line that they agree to receive transfusion. So, you know, in that case, you know, it's still going to be up to the institutional policy.
But specifically, you're talking about the first line, which is patient criteria. You would say informed consent must be obtained in a manner consistent with institutional policy, or how would you define it? I don't know. I mean, I would imagine that people are required to follow the policies of their facility. But.
And in the case of, I just wanted to point out, in the case of these out of hospitals, and especially if they're being done by a limited transfusion service, there would have to be that agreement between the transfusion service and the blood bank that's issuing the blood. So that should be clarified, how that the consent is being obtained, so that I think the blood bank policy would be overriding and driving the consent policy for the limited transfusion service.
I don't know that, I mean, there would have to be a limited transfusion service is going to have an agreement with blood resources, and their policies would be approved for that to happen. But certainly, it's still going to be up to the individual institution that's doing that, and they may have a different set of policies at the limited transfusion service than the hospital transfusion service or blood center would have for their own transfusions. Doesn't mean they're identical.
I agree with that. I know that by requirement for the limited transfusions is that the blood bank director of the issuing facility would be approving all of those policies. So, but I think it would still, we could require that. I don't think it's bad form for us to put the institutional guidelines for the informed consent policies into this as a suggested edit. I think it clarifies that. And then we can also, there is a guidance documents referenced here. It's called Recommendations for Consent for Transfusion. And we can add some additional language in there for how that affects a limited transfusion service. So it sounds like it would be a conversation between the LTS director and the blood bank director on how that informed consent is obtained and for what duration of time.
Wouldn't the blood bank have to agree to release the blood? So to release the blood to the outpatient facility, they'd already have to have an agreement.
Yes.
That they agree in all policies, and none of the policies other than the blood bank's policy would supersede or contradict. Well, no contradiction of policies at all. So that would all have to be in writing before they even enter into this proposition.
Yes, that's one of the requirements to receive the LTS approval, is that there be a written agreement, and we actually review that agreement between the LTS and the blood bank.
So with us versus the ATS versus the ambulances versus the LTS, I mean, we really only supply blood to facilities that are within our system and are required to follow the institutional policies. I don't know how that works. I know that maybe if people were talking about perhaps nursing homes or other things, you know, might participate, and they may have an agreement that is different. But practically speaking, I don't know.
There are some current agreements between dialysis centers and other entities outside of practices that are generally part of a network. So I know for some of the larger institutions like your oncology clinics and reinfusion clinics, those places that are part of your same institution have LTS approvals, but there are some agreements with entities that are distinct and independent from the blood bank network and ownership.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
This is Rachel again. I'm just curious about patient homes. Is that something that is happening? And how is that under a limited transfusion service? Is that a physician's office that is allowed to do that to their patient or the patients?
At this point, I don't know of any traveling limited transfusion service that does go to homes. I have heard of proposals that that a hospital may want to perform transfusions at like a hotel nearby to the hospital because there's just not enough beds and it's not an acute case. This is more for therapy. So I don't have any examples of it occurring in a patient home. Although there are some proposals being made for it to occur in nursing homes, which of course requires not only our approval, but also the approval of the other side of DOH for the surveillance of nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities. So that is a joint review and approval process. And there are currently none with that model approved. And that would essentially qualify as a patient's home in those instances. But again, there's none approved at this time.
I know we did it once. We set up a short-term LTS, and it was at a patient's home. And it was because, well, the reasons for it was that the physician had a long-term relationship with this patient and was caring for at the end of life and that kind of thing. And I think that from our point of view, it wasn't necessarily it was more so that the hospital could issue the blood to the physician caring for the patient in the home to provide us with a level of security, or a sense that, you know, we had some control versus maybe the physician who was providing the care. I mean, for them, it was like a doctor's office transfusion, but, you know, it's a different, the service, the purpose that it serves may be different. I don't know. Clearly, if you're doing it in a nursing home, which I think is something that people would prefer to do, that's a separate issue.
Yeah, there's been a renewed interest since COVID for having transfusions occur in a nursing home. But again, there's no approved models at this time.
I also noticed you want to clarify about being elective or non-emergent, but then you said except for ambulatory surgery centers. I mean, we do say this is elective. Are we proposing that you can do it in an emergent situation then?
I think for ambulatory surgery centers, depending on what level of service is being provided there, I think it's a there are some circumstances where it could be an emergent situation. And I know of ambulatory surgery centers that are actually hold full clinical laboratory permits with blood services, transfusion storage only on premises. So there's some circumstances where it is warranted. Just I think in those cases to stabilize and then move people to the hospital setting.
This is Dr. Jacobson. So what's the difference between a site that has blood storage only and an LTS?
The distinction is for an entity that holds a clinical laboratory permit for testing So if they hold any other category for the purpose of clinical testing, then we ask that they apply for a blood services transfusion storage only category be added to that existing permit. The limited transfusion service is really only meant for those facilities that don't otherwise hold a clinical laboratory permit. Functionally,
they're the same with regard to transfusion.
But yes. Yes. Okay. The only difference would be that for a laboratory that or an entity or a facility that holds a permit, they receive the on-site surveys for the testing component, and they also are reviewed for their transfusion component as well during those routine surveys. So there is a slightly higher level of scrutiny for those laboratories that are also those entities that are also doing testing.
Only a facility that holds a blood storage permit could have uncross-matched blood, or could anyone have uncross-matched blood? Because if you have uncross-matched blood, obviously you can provide blood in an emergency. But if you're an LPS and you don't have blood storage, you're not going to have uncross-matched blood because we would only have sent you blood for a scheduled transfusion.
Right, and that's what we've seen. Any of the agreements that we've seen for an LTS are typically cross-matched blood, these are scheduled transfusions. But yes, the transfusion storage only sites could be like in a standalone emergency department. They could be and those, you know, where they would be maintaining uncross-matched blood on premises for an emergent issue, for emergent situation.
Then it sounds like to me there should be a separate guidance for facilities that have blood storage permits and those that are just LTSs. Because right now it's confusing that we're mixing the two together. And they are all out of hospital transfusions, but they're really very different.
That's a fair point.
I mean, just to confirm, you're saying that an LTS can't store even temporarily uncross-matched blood. Is that
correct?
Correct.
I mean, it's elective, so you'd ask to get that unit ahead of time. So if somebody came in emergent, how would you have blood? That's what I was sort of confused about.
Yeah, this particular guidance document does reference that the facility or agency is approved by the department as an LTS. So I think, I understand that there could be out of hospital transfusions occurring in places like a standalone emergency department. They aren't a hospital, but they're still performing transfusions in necessary situations. And I know that those types of facilities are relatively new since this guideline was written in 2012. So another reason for revision.
And I haven't looked at the paperwork for a limited transfusion service in a long time, but that's clear when you look at that paperwork that it's only cross-matched blood from a facility that has a license in immunohematology, and it's only planned. And I know sometimes we talk about an ATS and a limited transfusion service as being similar to transfusion storage only, but we're saying that they're fundamentally different in how people use them.
Yeah, so I'm just looking up we have our model agreement for provision of blood to a limited transfusion service. So there's criteria in there where the blood bank agrees to certain requirements, and the transfusion, the limited transfusion service agrees. And I'm just reading through. So they're one of the requirements in the model agreement is that the patient meets requirements for out-of-hospital transfusion. They don't have a history of hemolytic or anaphylactic reactions. The patient's cooperative, able to communicate, gives informed consent. And there is a requirement for pre-transfusion testing. So these, in these instances for the LTSs, it would be all cross-matched.
So I think that what we're saying is it may not require a separate guidance document, but or guideline, but perhaps they could be broken out and it could be made clear that the intention of an LTS is for planned non-emergent transfusion, and that patients or facilities that anticipate a need for emergent transfusion would require transfusion storage only, or an ambulance transfusion service or something like that.
An ambulance transfusion service is typically meant just for a transport between facilities.
Yeah.
So that typically the transfusion is initiated at the hospital and then continued by the staff in the ambulance during transport. But yeah, we could certainly work on adding some clarity and breaking out specific requirements for the LTS versus an IE blood services storage only permit holder. All right, so under patient, and back to our guidance document, under the patient criteria, there's a statement about patients with unstable angina or congestive heart failure are not suitable candidates for out-of-hospital transfusions. But there's no mention of what types of patients would be eligible. So should we provide examples or even additional examples of who is not eligible, actually? So it's both eligible versus ineligible, and is it enough to say right now the requirement is that the person is cooperative, able to communicate history of hemolytic and anaphylactic reactions? Are there other criteria that we would say that because these are elective transfusions, who would be examples of the typical eligible patient?
I mean, I would be hard pressed to define it because usually there's, as you suggest, if there's a history of significant reactions, we may request that the patient be transfused in the hospital or in a treatment room in the hospital. We do end up in situations where people might have a history of congestive heart failure, but are reasonably well controlled and at the discretion of the physician, those patients may be transfused outpatient if they're considered to be relatively stable. It's an evaluation on a patient-by-patient basis to some extent. What we are usually concerned with, which may be what this reflects of, is that some of the off-site, off-campus, outside the hospital facilities are 911 call centers, and so if something goes wrong, then they won't get an emergency response team. But I don't know how other people feel about it. I just think it's a little bit certainly we want people to be evaluated. If we think they're high risk, then we'll discuss it with the physician and, you know, they can try and persuade us that it's acceptable. But we have people who may carry a diagnosis that maybe you'd suspect that they wouldn't be appropriate, but they've been transfused and they're okay. So, but you know, that's a diagnosis and not necessarily a reflection of the patient's status. Maybe other people have a different opinion.
Yeah, I'm a little confused because if it is elective, it, to me, means it's scheduled. So they're stable when they schedule, and if they're not stable, then they have to come in sooner. But I'm not sure if we're talking about then emergent, how we blend this all together. But this was supposed to deal with elective, I take it, scheduled transfusions out of hospital.
Right, so, there's currently the scope of the guidance document is for elective.
Correct, but like you could have a CHF patient who's on dialysis. You would want them to be transfused during dialysis because of the fluid shifts, and it's safer for them to be transfused then than it might be in another setting. But at the same time, it depends on the resources that that location has to deal with a patient who has any sort of medical episode, whether it's a transfusion reaction or any other kind of thing. So I think you can't just say just because someone has CHF that they aren't suitable to have an outpatient transfusion.
I mean, perhaps you could say that they should be evaluated. I mean, usually what we require is that if they're going to be transfused outpatient, that, you know, we have a discussion, but I don't know how you write that into a guideline.
Yeah, it's almost how much medical assistance do you have? I mean, a patient at home, which I don't think we do very often, versus at the dialysis center, they have, does that depend on how stable they, how unstable a patient could be that they can handle?
So it sounds to me like the guidance really needs to be, you know, like you're saying, it depends on the medical resources available at that specific site would define how the status that you would be able to, of the patient that you could be able to transfuse, right? So if you are at a home, if you are at a physician office, your patient must be very stable versus somebody at a dialysis center who could have other underlying issues, but you are prepared if there are emergent situations and
that
medical
sounds reasonable.
Episodes.
I think the individual facility or LTS needs to define the patient categories for themselves in their own policies as to what a patient, what eligibility criteria they are comfortable with. And that's an agreement between the LTS and the blood bank providing those products.
Okay.
Rather than us defining it for them, I think that each facility needs to define that. And obviously, if you're inspecting, you can inspect against those. And certainly when you approve the LTS, you're approving their policies.
Right. I think that's a fair point to say that it's going to be driven by what you can handle.
The safety of the patient, really,
yeah.
Right? What's safe for the patient.
Right.
Agreed. I think we have to make it very nebulous or not strict criteria.
Yeah.
Well, I think the facility may have to have criteria that are stricter, but I don't think the guidance should be strict, other than to say that the facility needs to define in conjunction with the LTS facility, in conjunction with the transfusion service, what types of patients are eligible for transfusion and who might be excluded based on the facility's ability to provide medical care.
That sounds reasonable.
I mean, in practice, I don't find it contentious. If we have patients who historically have been fragile and don't do well with outpatient transfusion, usually the physician doesn't want to be called about it, and they don't want to have to deal with all of these things either. So often, you know, they'll make allowances for bringing the patient in-house just so that it's a smoother process and easier for everybody.
Okay.
So how are we leaving that? Are we leaving it such that we would leave the unstable angina or congestive heart failure, or say something that, you know, unstable patients such as this may not be appropriate and should be evaluated by the facility?
I think I would go with the latter, that, you know, if there's a question about their cardiorespiratory status, that there would be an evaluation and a determination, and the facility that would be administering the transfusion would have to assess their ability to handle any potential medical episodes, so that it would be that evaluation and just not only the patient, but also their ability to handle an issue. And determining whether that patient can then be transfused in that site.
Okay.
So we'll try to draft some language to send around. All right. All right, the next section we wanted to talk about in that same guidance document was about staffing. Right now, it talks about one thing we wanted to do is change the language from healthcare personnel to healthcare professionals, just because these are typically licensed individuals. And that would be in that first sentence where it says only qualified licensed healthcare personnel meeting New York State Department of Health regulatory requirements may initiate, administer, and monitor transfusions. So that our first change would be from changing personnel to professional. The other section, the next sentence of this particular paragraph talks about two competent adults other than the recipient, one of whom must be authorized to initiate transfusions, must be present at all times. And not knowing the history of the development of this particular guidance document, I wasn't quite sure what competent adult meant, because I was under the belief that it would have to be somebody that was approved to administer the transfusion. So that means that they were a healthcare professional. So I don't know if anybody knows the development of this guidance document. So. Or the history of that?
Did you say it was defined in the regulation, or it's not defined?
I think it's mentioned in the regulation. I don't believe competent adult is defined in the regulation. I'm just going to...
Hi, this is Dr. Schmidt. I had a question. For the transfusions that are allowed at various locations, you know, such as, you know, particularly the patient homes, which we said is not actually happening, but we're writing a document regarding it because we didn't remove it. Usually, if someone's going to a patient home, there's only one person. So do two people, are there usually two people that are going to the patient homes that would be able to do this?
Our requirement is that there be two people at the patient bedside for identification purposes. So there, you know, we would expect there to be two people at least to initiate. Although that kind of brings up our other discussion about what's the utility of virtual RNs, but we're going to wait for that for later.
We're saying that one of the people cannot be related to the patient. Like they couldn't be you know, a family member or someone that is, you know, a second person. So these, the people that are going to the patient's house have to be a team of healthcare professionals.
I'm not, did we say that? I was thinking it was a family member that had to be competent, that there's two people there, but are we saying they have to send two people? I wonder if that's...
It's unclear.
I mean, a competent as far as not competent for transfusion, but otherwise then they'd be licensed or...
So can one of the people be a friend, family, or whatever, or are they two licensed professionals?
How would a family member be deemed trained and competent to do, to function in terms of reviewing, you know, the unit numbers and the product codes and all of the other things that have to happen when you hang a unit of blood?
What people end up doing, you know, in a home visit is beyond me, to be honest with you, but a lot of times things do slide. I mean, in the case of children or people who are quite ill, a family member takes on significant responsibilities. You know, some of the times, you know, the parent, you know, does, you know, enteral feedings. They do all types of, you know, line dressings and, you know,
I understand all of that, but blood is regulated very differently than other drugs, at least in New York State.
So the way this states, it's only one person must be authorized to initiate.
Well, it really should be two people.
That's kind of what we're trying to figure out.
It just says two competent adults.
Yeah.
One of which,
one has to be an RN or such, and the other one could just be a competent adult. Anyone over the age of 18 who can read would be per se competent, who makes sense.
And I don't recall when we did this. I think I was there, and I think we were thinking a family member if we were doing home, because that was where we were. I don't know. I don't think they were sending two people. Do you remember back then?
What's required under the regulations versus what's required under the guidelines? Does the regulation clear that it has to be, or is that not an issue?
Doesn't FDA require two people unless you're using a computer that serves as the secondary patient identification matching?
So in our regulation,
only one is RN.
There would be two people.
Yep.
We're just debating the second one in.
Yeah, but most of the time we think of people as being trained and deemed competent. So unless you're going to do competency on a family member in advance of doing this, how are you going to have that type of information?
Right, but the thing is, you're talking to a variety of professionals here, and we're all saying that the way we're reading it is competent just means that someone is of sound mind and body.
I understand that's what it says, but I don't know that what it says actually meets the requirement.
I think that's what we're agreeing to, that it doesn't meet the requirement.
Right. So I'm from our regulation, the only time that it's mentioned is under 58.2.16, talks about it in paragraph G, that in an transfusion outside of a healthcare setting, including those in a patient's home, that a person authorized to monitor transfusion and another competent adult other than the recipient shall be immediately available at all times during a transfusion. There is no definition of what competent adult means, and that's where we're struggling internally to try and figure, because when people ask us that, what does that mean? I don't know. So that's why I am asking, you know, why we posed this question. What does that, what was the intention, and what should that be defined as?
How about two licensed professionals? You know, it doesn't have to necessarily be a second RN, but it could be an LPN or, you know, someone who holds something. But I don't know that, you know, someone's, you know, parent or, you know, husband or wife would necessarily function to verify that, you know, the blood is of the correct bag, it's of the correct typing. They wouldn't necessarily know.
That's mainly a clerical. Right. And I might, I'm not sure if David, do you remember, but I think we were thinking that it is a family member that is doing the clerical check. The nurse has to be there the whole time.
I believe that was right because of logistically speaking, getting two RNs or two licensed people in the house at the same time to do this might not be able to happen. So someone that actually is competent and ability to speak English and read would be able to check the numbers, because all they're doing is reading off numbers.
Yeah, you're sending a unit to this home.
Sometimes the things get mislabeled. So how, you know, let's say you're giving, you know, your person is B, for some odd reason, you know, an A bag got sent. The average person who is a family member, unless they're in healthcare, may not necessarily recognize the implications of that.
And I think that's when the responsibility falls back to that licensed professional that's there.
I mean, it's just a clerical, and if it's not the same, it's not the same. And nobody would give a, you know, if they're O and A, they would notice.
And the numbers wouldn't match. I mean, just reading a number off, reading eight numbers off, they won't match. If they don't match,
right. Right.
Well, the numbers could match, you know, if the blood bank gave someone made a clerical error at the blood bank, and then they tagged the wrong piece of blood.
That's true. They could
match numbers.
But currently, nobody's doing this at homes, right? Currently, nobody's
that we're aware of right now, no.
So you're free, in a sense, to provide a guideline that says that these would be the requirements that we would expect people to meet. And if somebody were to say, I'm going to set up an agency that does this home transfusion, then we could say that they need two licensed people, or one licensed person and another trained, competent employee. You've got that luxury because you're not trying to fit it in. It's not like it's widespread currently and we're trying to define those roles. You know, this is really for a future state. If it was a dialysis center, I think you would expect two people to do the identification, right?
Who would be healthcare professionals, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is just for those cases that may rise up, either as part of an agency that does this professionally or some oddball thing that people may choose to engage in. And I think that I don't think it's unreasonable to say that you would require two people to go to the house or whatever. And I don't think it's unreasonable to say even that one of those people is a licensed professional and another one might be someone that's trained but not necessarily licensed. I don't really know. You know, maybe that's considered competent. I'm not sure.
But in that case,
you could say an employee under the control of and trained in the procedures thereof.
I don't even know if we considered transfusions at home back then, 2012. It was kind of an abstract that we would do that because we had adequate at that time hospital and these other limited transfusion services in facilities like dialysis units and such. As a registered nurse, I'd feel more comfortable with another licensed person there, or at least a trained individual professional. Could be an aide that was trained, but that cannot hang blood, of course, or a licensed practical nurse. Another registered nurse, that would be fine also, but then again, you're logistically taxing the system again. There's so many of us around. Yes. And we're getting fewer and fewer by the day.
I mean, I think when we did this, after talking to Dr. Linden years ago, the major concerns were not necessarily the identification, but if you had the patient had a significant reaction, how would you deal with that if you only had one person present, and is that something you could manage? So, you know, those safety concerns are not insignificant if you're doing it in a house.
Right, and I guess if there was a significant reaction, that competent adult for a family member, that RN is going to have to require them to call the ambulance and do all those other things. I mean, and then that's really the issue, is can they do that? And whereas and people, of course, react to stress in different ways. So I'm just thinking that at least a licensed, or not maybe not licensed, but at least a trained individual is a bit more reasonable than, you know, laying that responsibility onto a family member. But like I said, I understand that there's going to be, you know, with the current shortages that we have, another licensed LPN, RN would be difficult, but at least if there was a trained aide that could be accompanying the RN, that would be helpful.
As guidelines, these are not binding requirements.
Right.
These are recommendations.
True.
However, not following our recommendations could incur legal situations.
It's a financial penalty.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the next question we had, what is the expectation for present at all times? Does this mean within the patient room or the immediate patient care area? Does it mean within earshot? Does it mean with visual eyes on that patient at all times during the transfusion? That's one of the questions that, especially for an LTS situation and for the questions that we've been receiving about possibility of transfusion in nursing homes, what is the expectation?
The definition, are we going with a legal definition of physically present, mean within audible range and in such proximity that immediate assistance can be given if required? And that's with one government documents in Illinois State and Villanova.
Oh, that's fabulous. Okay. We don't have a definition.
So I mean, that sounds like a wonderful definition, but we might want to add that they have to physically be present, like bedside, for the first 15 or so minutes.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Again, I think we were addressing who might be around. I mean, if you're in a medical facility, I mean, they don't do that in the hospital. So, but if you're in the home, I guess they were figuring you'd have to be right there. You can't be wandering around. So I guess it depends on the location. Again,
they don't do in a hospital? I'm sorry.
Oh, they're not right at the bedside the whole
But usually for the first 15 minutes.
Right, yeah. They do. Right.
Yeah, someone just needs to be with the patient, like literally holding their hand for 15 minutes, and then they just need to be able to hear if something is going wrong and they're not feeling well. Because there's no button that they're going to be able to push.
Right.
But if they're ambulatory, they would be able to. At some areas, they would be.
Push a button, ambulatory?
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, the ambulatory surgery centers. We're mixing and matching a little bit. Yeah.
I think that's good guidance. I mean, it just says present in all times, but I agree that it should be close proximity at the bedside for at least the first 15 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then an audible range sounds like a reasonable definition for the remainder of the transfusion. And then in both, in the regulation for both the healthcare setting and for transfusion outside a healthcare setting, there is a requirement for 30 minutes thereafter, which would again be in audible range, I would believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, we say within audible range, that's including if they have a button to push or something like that where they could. So if they were at the station and somebody pushed the button, that's within audible range? Or
I think that that would meet the definition, yes.
Sure.
As long as that patient is capable, sure. I'm going to have to copy your definition again.
Here, you can take everything. Actually, you can have it. I have one home.
Oh, thank you. Yes. And again, that the definition was physically present means within audible range and in such proximity that immediate assistance can be given if required.
Yes.
So that sounds reasonable. Great. Thank you. Okay, the other section we wanted to talk about for the out-of-hospital transfusion was about the storage. Basically, this document refers to another document called the Guidelines for Remote Blood Storage, and that if the blood is not going to be administered immediately upon receipt, it should be maintained appropriately. For an LTS, we would like to take it a bit further. We typically don't encourage an LTS to hold units overnight. And typically, if there's a refrigerator of some sort, we would consider them to almost be serving as a blood bank, because now they could be taking multiple units out of a fridge, and what's the control to make sure that those are being assigned to the appropriate patient. I think we want some of your input on all the different places where your blood banks are issuing. Do they have this capability? Are those units typically being stored overnight? If for whatever reason the transfusion was either canceled or postponed, you know, what's your practical experience?
So if you were to deliver it, this is just if it's not transfused as planned. So like if you were to ship it and put it in a controlled refrigerator the night before for use the next day, that would be acceptable, right? It's just that if they're not transfused as scheduled? Or...
No, you couldn't put it in a refrigerator without monitoring every 4 hours.
Right. Or if it was one that's hooked up to your system, if it's hooked up to
We would be putting it in a cooler to transport, right? You'd be sending it in something appropriate for transport.
Most of these places would not have a refrigerator that is on the system of the blood distributor or the blood service that gave them the blood.
So for the coolers, they'd only be able to keep it on site for the duration that cooler is validated to hold temperature.
Correct.
Right. It's usually validated.
So then they would have to be returned probably by the end of the day.
So what we have actually, I mean, this is mostly at the transfusion storage only facilities, but is that we ship the blood there in the morning. It goes into a refrigerator, and then if the nurse wants it to transfuse at the facility, they pick it up and then they bring it to the bedside. So it does go into a refrigerator short term, and those refrigerators are checked, but they're also hooked up to our electronic monitoring system. I don't know.
Yeah, I would think there's a lot of different systems here because we're talking a lot of different places, dialysis, ambulatory. I mean,
and I could just see people, you know, places where they may prefer not to use the cooler, where they may even ship it over the night before, but I don't know if that's permissible. I don't know whether those are transfusion storage only facilities or LTSs, but certainly it could be, you know, that may be preferable. So I don't know how you would define it.
I guess the wording should be that it's, you know, for whatever storage time, you have to return it in that time frame. Like if you have a cooler, you got to return it. And if it's in a, I mean, what is the regulation? How long can you keep it in the, but it's a maintained refrigerator. I mean, a monitored, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we're saying too is that if it's not transfused at the anticipated time, then it should be returned.
Otherwise, it's discarded. You know, it's not.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We get it back so that we discard it in our computer system because, you know, the LTSs may not have the ability to account for it the same way, but I'd imagine people have different.
The temperature was maintained, we would put it back into circulation.
Usually it's related also to that we have to do a visual inspection before we would reissue it and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to beef up wording? But I don't. But it has to be stored appropriately, and if it's returned and it hasn't been stored appropriately, thrown out. If it has been stored appropriately, it's okay.
Or stored appropriately in a monitored or approved system.
Yeah. That would be.
But how are we leaving this so that we wouldn't store it overnight if it wasn't transfused as intended? Is that, or if it's returned?
Well, where you run into problems is depending on when the pre-transfusion specimen was and whether now the cross matches more than 72 hours. Whether the specimen that you use for compatibility is valid anymore.
Oh, you're talking about transfusing it the next day.
Well, if they've kept it, they might transfuse it the next day.
Right.
But you can run into problems with the specimen no longer being valid, depending on when you got that pre-transfusion specimen. And then you're relying on even less informed people to recognize that the specimen now may be expired and the cross match no longer considered valid.
I mean, practically speaking, it's not a problem because usually what happens is if somebody comes in for a transfusion or if they've ordered blood for a transfusion and the patient misses their appointment or something like that, usually they return it because they always return it, but I think a lot of times it's because the patient didn't need transfusion and they just evaluated on the basis of the labs and decided not to transfuse. And that's 95% of them. It's not that they show up the next day, but we wouldn't allow them to keep it overnight anyway.
So maybe the wording is must be returned, can't transfuse, or if it's been canceled. For whatever reason.
You could put a time period, must be returned within 8 hours of patient's scheduled transfusion time if not used or something like that, within so many hours of, that way it couldn't be kept overnight.
But what she's trying to address is that somebody might use the unit again rather than not return it. Right, that's your main concern.
Either.
Is somebody, yeah, not the storage of it. It's just that it needs to be returned.
But if you have a defined time period, they have to.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think it would be a problem if it was 12 hours, right?
Yeah, but it would get into the night. So 12 hours could be the next day.
Right, but you can't use it on that patient.
So just to get back to this is only non-emergence, right? So like places that are
scheduled
as part of a freestanding ED or something like that, that's not covered?
I believe all the freestanding emergency departments would hold a permit for blood service transfusion storage only. So they would not be an LTS, which I believe the way that this current guidelines out of hospital transfusion guidelines document is written is really meant for the LTSs. So we'll have, like we discussed earlier, we'll have to revise and add some language for the transfusion storage only sites. But in those cases, I think the expectation for any of those freestanding EDs is that they would maintain a refrigerator, a controlled refrigerator, with the with all units on hand all the time.
Okay, so if it's not transfused at the as scheduled, or what does this say? Then it should be returned. And I don't know, you know, if it's in a controlled refrigerator or something like that, you may, I don't know what everybody's transportation things are. I mean, what if you had somebody that was supposed to be scheduled at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, would they have to pick it up that day, or could they keep it in the refrigerator if it was a monitored secure refrigerator? I don't know. Pick it up the next day, and then, you know,
there's no reason it couldn't be picked up the next day if it's in an appropriately monitored, secured refrigerator.
But an LTS.
But even in an LTS, if they, assuming it was like a Monday to Friday scenario, and, you know, you were going back the next day to drop off blood for another patient, you could pick it up theoretically the next morning. They just shouldn't, you know, transfuse it beyond that day, the original day.
Or practically speaking, you could say must be returned to the issuing blood bank prior to transfusion, and if not returned immediately, should be stored in a controlled or monitored refrigerator for the minimum amount of time, not exceeding 12 or 24 hours, I don't know. But, you know, that's...
Right. I'm really just wondering.
Really, it's just a question of wasting.
I mean, they should have the same criteria for when they have to discard it, too. Like, if they go to transfuse, they can't get an IV access, and it's been an hour, half an hour, they have to follow the same guidelines that you can't, you have to discard that, right? And if it can't be stored appropriately, it has to be discarded also. But the blood bank would want it back to discard? Or not?
Blood bank's going to want it back because they need to have their own records reflect that the patient didn't receive that transfusion.
We also have to know that it can't be used for anybody else if they left it out too long.
Right.
I understand that. We would
no,
not.
I just, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we would expect the blood bank to have all those records, so it should be returned even if unusable, and then the blood bank would dispose.
Right.
And the facility has to have a process how to designate that unit as one that wasn't properly stored so that the transfusion service didn't put it back, or the blood bank didn't put it back into inventory.
Yep. Okay. All right, that's helpful. I think that Dr. Hilbert mentioned that if we can add some language that says if it's not used as for the scheduled transfusion, that it would be returned within, you know, returned to the blood bank for appropriate disposition and within at least, I would say, 24 hours. It may be difficult depending on certain schedules to force it to the end of the day, but as long as it's maintaining the proper temperature, in the validated cooler or in a refrigerator, I think that sounds reasonable.
It is.
Okay. All right, so on our document, we talked about there's been some inquiries about the use of virtual RNs in certain areas of the hospital settings. This is going a little bit off topic from the out-of-hospital transfusions, but this is specifically to hospital settings where there are certain procedures right now where there's the development of virtual RN systems. So there would be someone, you know, WebExing or some FaceTime or some audio-visual presence of a registered nurse to assist with certain procedures in the healthcare facility. So that would serve as the second RN for those procedures. And the question to us is, of course, would that virtual RN meet the criteria as the second person to verify the bedside identification of the unit and the patient for purpose of transfusion? And our, you know, that's really, we've been asked that question. Go ahead.
This is actually, how are they envisioning the virtual RN? I mean, are they carrying her or him around on a tablet where they're saying, here's John Doe, here's John Doe's bracelet? Like, how are they verifying it that it's the same person and it's all like the same? I like, what is the description that you're getting of this virtual RN?
We haven't gotten very detailed description at all about what services are out there. Just doing some Googling, I mean, it is basically is a tablet of some sort with a camera, and, you know, that person would be huge. Yeah, you'd have to focus them on the patient, the wristband, the unit, and it's a little...
You mean just for the ID? I mean, how can they monitor if you're not going to be able to do a, somebody else is doing
Yeah, there'd still be a person, there'd still be a licensed person present in the room. This would just be the second person for the purposes of the bedside identification. So, so there'd still be an LPN RN in that room, physically present. This person would just be, instead of, you know, if they weren't able to get another licensed person to do the identification verification, that's where this person would, this virtual RN process would be incorporated. And I kind of, you know, trying to trouble or devil's advocate, it's very similar in certain ways to the systems now where you have the, I think Epic has one where it's, you're using the barcodes to verify your blood units and your patient and for your bedside. So it's electronic verification and it was intended to replace that second person for the bedside identification. So I think it's very similar in intent. But that is one of the things that we don't have any guidance on is also those electronic identification mechanisms.
Electronic mechanisms, DPAM, that's FDA approved.
It is approved, but our guidance documents haven't caught up to that yet. And that's actually one of the other topics.
I recognize that New York State doesn't have that, but that's different than a virtual RN.
Yeah.
I mean, that's using an FDA approved computer system for its intended purpose.
But you're talking about in the non-healthcare setting, so this would be in places like dialysis centers or places like patient homes? Or
this would only be in a healthcare setting.
In healthcare settings, I think they should have people in real life. I don't think virtual is appropriate in a healthcare setting.
When you're talking virtual also, is that person available or are they at home? I mean, and this is in the hospital. So why... Would you
could be shopping?
How
they don't specify. Yeah.
But what if something goes wrong and they have to report to them? Are they going to be able to come down and help? How virtual?
I don't know how far away they are. They could be in a different city. They could be down the hall. They don't specify. This question, we received this question from the program division of hospitals, so of DOH, asking if it would be acceptable. So I don't know what their particular position is. I haven't talked to the hospital program if they are allowing it for other non-transfusion procedures, but this was one of the questions we received, but we don't know how to respond.
So you're talking about a hospital that has so few people working in it that they can't spare a second person to go in and verify who someone is for 2 minutes.
Seems very odd.
No, this is not appropriate.
Sounds like the general consensus is that we aren't comfortable with that. Okay.
Who is proposing that? Unless somebody came from this virtual RN person, I would agree. I'd rather have a family member then. Sorry, yeah, throw that in, but wow. That is odd. But who exactly?
I just trying to understand what setting that this would be required in. Because, you know, as we say, you know, surgical centers or cancer centers or, you know, well, so if it's an LTS, I mean, this is with respect to inpatients, it's very difficult to foresee when that would be required. If it's a dialysis center and they only have one nurse or something, I mean, do those usually I think about them being bigger and busier than that, but
they said that it was a division of hospital, so it has to be a hospital.
Yes, it is definitely a hospital or diagnostic and treatment center where this would be proposed.
It's like an ICU.
Maybe they should come and discuss it or
tell them about the electronic identification system that's also they could use.
Right. So it's reading through just because I got a very general inquiry. It basically says the virtual nurse would be intended to assist the nurse at the bedside and watch the monitor and data that is being fed to the software.
Telemetry.
The virtual nurse would also provide education and be present during interdisciplinary rounds, provide guidance to the nurse at the bedside. This isn't specific to any blood administration procedures. It would supplement in-person nursing and not replace it.
I mean, this sounds like a question of whether virtual nursing is equivalent to on-site nursing, and you know, that's probably a bigger question than simply transfusion. I think it would be interesting to hear have to say and when they would propose it, but you know, the decision as to what virtual nurses can do and can't do, I think is probably not really a question for us, except with
For the bedside identification, you know, in a hospital setting, it's supposed to be two licensed professionals. If they're not physically present, but they are licensed professionals, do they meet that criteria?
But are there guidelines for virtual nursing otherwise? Like, or is that is the Office of the Professions or whoever regulates that?
New York State Department of Education should be addressing this situation, and within scope of practice for a registered nurse, can you become a virtual nurse?
And how is an individual hospital going to do competency and training on a virtual nurse from another location? Because you have to have those records.
I mean, in theory, could. I'm not saying that, but it's.
Well, I don't think
they could be employees. Yeah, they could be employees of that hospital.
or contract employees.
Yeah.
So what if the virtual nurse notices that the person is, you know, their vital signs are disturbing and they're, you know, going towards a code? Is she gonna, she's going to get on the phone and try to reach someone by the telephone?
Well, I think in this case, that, you know, they're saying that the virtual nurse would not replace the in-person, the bedside person.
It's in the hospital.
But she's monitoring the vital signs. Here she is monitoring vital signs. They can't run down the hallway. They can't go into the room. They can't do, what can they do?
Shout really loud.
Yeah, shout.
Dial light on.
No, I agree. They can't imagine any kind of, they can't manage any emergent issues, any severe reactions. So
they couldn't even stop the blood.
No.
I would say no, and I agree with the other person's comment to send it to the Department of Education.
I mean, I can inquire with nursing here and see whether there's any, you know, guidance on the use of virtual nursing. I think, you know, in this question of, you know, we spoke about how you monitor transfusion and that you have to be within audible range and all that. I guess you could argue, is it physically audible range or is it, you know, but I think it's a bigger question than for us, but our it seems like the consensus is that, you know, you still have a nurse there. So what is the value of this in the transfusion setting? Is it really just to assist in the two-person sign-off, or is it, does it have other implications?
I think that based off of the way that they're phrasing it is that they would try to release the nurse who is physically there from her 15 to 20 minutes of watching the transfusion, because this nurse would be quote-unquote watching it from afar, you know, watching the vital signs and such. The problem is that she couldn't do anything.
Oh, I didn't get that. Is this just an ID? And that the nurse, there is a nurse, there is a second RN there.
There is a second RN in the
room
somewhere, yes. But they didn't designate the particular, from what I gather from the question, they didn't designate the particular scenario in which the second nurse, you know, these virtual RN would be used. No one ever has anyone, particularly places of business, has a second person, you know, that's doing something virtually for no reason at all. So there's got to be a reason that they're trying to get a virtual person to do something. It's got to be relieving some issue. That's a benefit.
Well, when they're trying to do two identifiers, I do know sometimes there's an issue getting two identifiers, two people to come into the room so that they can.
They may have to delay it by 10 or 15 minutes, but they should be able to find someone eventually.
Right. Well, that's what we're saying. But I think I didn't get that impression. I got the impression that the RN was with another person at the bedside, and she was just the, is that what's proposed?
Can you read to us one more time?
Or they don't know.
Yep. I think, you know, we can kind of determine, that's the role here is determine what would be the acceptable activities for a virtual RN. But what I've got here is that the virtual RN is intended to assist the nurse at the bedside, watch the monitor and data that is being fed to the software. They are intended to supplement the in-person nursing and not replace it.
It's very ambiguous.
Looking to see if, yes, it is.
I would say no, it's not applicable for transfusion, and send it to the Department of Education and let them figure out what it's useful for.
But I mean, the requirement now is that you have two people do the identification and then one person monitor thereafter, right? So as long as
they can leave the room.
So as long as that person is still doing what they were doing, they can certainly have somebody assist virtually. but it doesn't eliminate the pre-existing responsibilities. The only case, I guess, it would be of value to them would be in the two-person identification. And then the suggestion, I guess, we had was that they should be using some sort of FDA-approved system for this, or if the Department of Education, or if, you know, whoever else monitors hospitals, I don't know in general what the guidelines are for what nurses have to do. They let them do it for chemotherapy? I don't know. Is
that, right.
Are there other instances in which they've made some evaluation?
McCarthy, yeah, for chemotherapy, you do not have to have two nurses. You do the initial check, and then the second nurse can go away and do something else.
So this question is for Dr. McCarthy. Do you feel comfortable, because I believe you're a hemonc doctor, do you feel comfortable, using one real nurse in person and one virtual nurse to verify the chemotherapy that's going to be administered to a patient?
I would be, we would not want to do that because most of the time people are receiving chemotherapy in a chemo infusion center. If they're getting chemotherapy at home, it's something that's relatively low risk. And so that would be a different situation. But most of the time we're giving infusions at home. We don't give chemotherapy at home.
But we're talking about inpatient.
Inpatient, there's no need for a virtual nurse. It really should be two live nurses.
Okay.
We wouldn't be able to do it.
I think we have a consensus there.
Practically speaking, I think like in an ED or something where you have nurses around, it would probably take them longer to set up the virtual nurse than it would to just, you know, ask them to step in.
Grab an LPN.
But, I it could be that they've got a very good reason why this would work, and it could be that this is approved for other nursing functions. I'm just not aware of it.
So before we go on to discuss the other guidance, we are scheduled to end at 11.
Okay.
And somebody needs this room at 11:15.
Okay.
So, Bev, if you think this will be a quick discussion, I suggest we move forward. If not, I suggest maybe we table it and reconvene maybe sooner than a year from now.
It is very, so the one thing that we wanted to bring up again is very related to what we were just talking about. Our guidance document doesn't really specify that the use of the electronic identification, the FDA approved software. And so I think that it's just a, kind of a general statement that we need to revise our document, our guidance document, possible strategies for reduction of transfusion-related errors to address the use of those FDA-approved software systems.
This seems somewhat antiquated or also wishful thinking on some of this, and it really does need to be updated, and you need this. I mean, I don't remember ever seeing this one.
Oh, it's on this one. I think is, I'm trying to remember how old this one is. Yeah, this was 2000, so this is 23 years old right now.
I haven't seen this at all.
It doesn't seem. It's not. It's really old.
It is. So that's one of the why we targeted it for revision, because it really is. So, I think.
Is it worthwhile revising, or I just bring it up? I mean, is it something?
So are you saying that we don't need it, or are we just, we're gonna, you know, completely overhaul it and repeal and replace it?
Just asking. I think it needs to be completely overhauled, and is it going to be useful?
Yeah, I think I personally feel that it should be completely overhauled, and that's kind of our intention. I think it's still useful, although it's probably redundant to a lot of your AABB guidelines and other organizations that are out there.
Later meeting for.
Yeah. That one, I think we'll have to end here for our discussions, but I really appreciate everybody's input. Certainly a lot of valuable information. And like I said, we'll put together a draft that we'll share prior to our next meeting so we can discuss this further. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we move to adjourn? Do we already move?
Before we adjourn quickly, we have to open the floor to any public comments. So if anybody from the public would like to make any comments, now would be the time. Okay, Dr. Hilbert.
Thank you all. That concludes today's agenda. You guys can hear me, right? May I have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
I'll move to adjourn. Rachel.
Seconded?
Jessica Jacobson, second.
Any other discussion? No. So a roll call vote on the motion. Dr. Elder?
Dr. Elder?
Approved. To go.
Dr. Husky?
Dr. Husky?
Approved.
Jessica approved already. Dr. McCarthy?
Dr. McCarthy?
Approved.
Beverly, I think.
Approved.
Dr. Schmidt?
I approve as well.
Okay, thank you. We're adjourned.
Thank you.